Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 8th of December. I've been looking forward to this hour for some time since I started reading David's book, The Man for Whom Camp David Was Named. Actually, one of the men. The other was another family relative of Ike's. David Eisenhower is with us this hour. He is the author of several books looking at the presidency of his grandfather. This one is a very personal look, as well as a reflection on President Eisenhower's views on a number of important subjects, including Vietnam and the space race and the military-industrial complex and more. The book is Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. These were the years when he left the White House in 61 and moved to Gettysburg. And David and his family lived very, very close to his grandfather. He worked on his grandfather's farm. They had great conversations and went to Europe together. And David reflects on all of that in a very personal way in this particular book. We'll be welcoming phone calls for David, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. David is now director of the Institute for Public Service at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's also author of the bestseller Eisenhower at War, 1943 to 1945, which is a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History. David, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've had a chance to have your father on a couple times, and I've always loved those conversations. He's a great guy.
Well, he's a great guy. He's doing well, and he is somebody who has fulfilled a lifetime ambition over the last 20 or 25 years by publishing a long line of history books, and I know he has been out there over the last two decades, and he's the most prolific writer in our family, that's for sure.
Well, you're getting up there.
new book now, and more to come, but I've got a ways to go before I match Dad.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this book so much. It was filled with great little reminiscences you had of those very human and tender moments with your grandfather, plus this real meaty information about his place on the world stage and dealings with other presidents and different political philosophies. It's just a nice mix.
Well, Kathleen, that's a good way of putting it. That's the way it came out. Some time ago, I just decided I wanted to make a record of the years in Gettysburg and when I was in prep school and early college, when I was growing up and my grandfather was growing old. And I wanted to make a record of it. And the way it came out is that we had a lot in common almost by accident. See, I went away to prep school, and so we have a correspondence. That's one thing that my grandfather really didn't have with a lot of other members of his family because they were all around. I was away, so we had a wonderful correspondence. And one is I'm coming of age. I'm literally 21 when he passes away. I turned 21 on the day of his funeral, in fact. That's one thing that's happening. The other thing that is happening is what he is. He's a former president, former supreme commander in Europe. He is somebody who's surrounded by former associates. He's surrounded by the Republican Party in the 1960s, which is trying to forge a major comeback in national affairs. And so national politics is happening around him. He is also writing memoirs. He's looking back on a long career in life in national affairs, and many of the personages of that past are also sort of parading through Gettysburg. So this is what's happening. But the other story that's happening is that our family is all there together in Gettysburg, and we are starting a new life with a former president.
All right. Well, let's start with one of those lighter moments, except that it'll take us back to his military career in a way, too. And this was, he had not driven a car since, 1941? So he's learning how to drive. And you and your family are terrified at the prospect of granddad being behind the wheel.
Absolutely. You know, he hadn't done, he had not driven for 20 years. He had not even placed a phone call and things like this. And when he leaves the presidency, 1961, all the pampering is over. He puts himself on some sort of retraining regime. He's going to learn how to drive. He's going to learn how to handle himself around the farm. And, Kathleen, you can imagine the situation we were in.
Right.
He learns the driver's manual. He takes the car out on the farm and puts around the property. But then, for better or for worse, he shows up at the Pennsylvania State Highway headquarters for a driver's exam. Now, what is the state trooper going to say? General Eisenhower, sorry. They pronounce him an excellent driver. And pass him, of course, and that means that every day Dad's in the sling for a ride downtown, and I'm in the sling for a ride to the golf course. And this was a real adventure. I describe one episode that I remember very well, and that was he was navigating Confederate Avenue. That's a busy street in Gettysburg, just choked with tourists, and he's reciting. Articles and chapters from his driver's manual and so forth as he's seeing what everybody else is doing wrong. He's leaning on his horn and scaring everybody to death, and here I am hanging on for dear life.
Oh, my gosh.
In the car. That was typical.
And you talk about Gettysburg. There were some really major celebrations in Gettysburg,
yes.
And your grandfather was quite a military historian of the
yes.
Civil War and other times, too. Do you want to just take one of those on, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address? Or?
Well, sure. The 1960s represented the centennial of the American Civil War. That had big significance for America because 100 years out from the American Civil War, people begin to ask questions like, have the promises of emancipation been fulfilled? Has America met its own standards for extending equality under law to all Americans? These are questions that begin in 1961 when John Kennedy is inaugurated, and this centennial celebration carries over into 1963, which is big in the town of Gettysburg. The Battle of Gettysburg, fought July 1 through 3, 1863, is the greatest battle ever fought on northern soil, and it is the setting for probably the most famous speech ever delivered in American history, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And mm-hmm. we're celebrating the 100th anniversaries of all of these things, and two things happen. One is there we are on the farm, and in evenings, let's say once or twice a week, we had dinner in the main residence, and my grandfather and father, who had always loved the American Civil War as a topic, are conducting almost bi-weekly seminars on the American Civil War, the various command personalities, this battle, and others. In other words, the history of the Civil War is being recalled. Simultaneously, 1963 is the year of a great awakening in civil rights in America.
Yes.
So Dwight Eisenhower is called on to give a talk on June 30th in the Gettysburg area on the meaning of the Battle of Gettysburg. He is enlisted to rededicate the National Cemetery at Gettysburg on November 19th, 1963, which is the 100th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. And these are very significant and, I think, moving moments. And what they reminded me as a 15-year-old that summer is that Gettysburg is a very special place. We do have places in America which are unusual or special. Gettysburg is one of the most historic sites in the entire country. It's certainly a reason that the Eisenhowers decided to retire there and to buy a farm. They wanted to be within the within reach of this wonderful site.
Mm, I envy you, your being able to spend those coming-of-age years there. Let's talk a little bit more about civil rights. You say in the book that it had been the most important domestic issue of Eisenhower's second term. This is a matter of justice, he declared in 1956, not of anything else. His administration, right, as you well know, and you deal with this in the book, has been criticized for not taking on this issue, right, in a heartier way during his second administration.
Well, I think that what the civil rights story really has to be taken, several administrations have to be taken as a piece. And what happened in America post-war is that the courts took the lead. The political branches were stalled on civil rights in the late 40s, early 50s. Mm-hmm. President Truman, to give him credit, would propose things like anti-lynching laws, FEPC laws, things like this. And he was blocked in his own party. The country was just sort of stalemated on it. And so the courts stepped in, the Warren Court stepped in, and essentially decreed separate but equal, or this entire structure of segregation, to be unlawful. And so the Eisenhower presidency understands that it is faced with a major domestic issue. This is from about 1956 or 57 on, and it's a two-step process. One is enlisting the legislative and the executive branches into a civil rights program, joining the courts, in other words, to pass implementing legislation that would give effect to the 14th Amendment, 13th Amendment, which these amendments themselves invite the Congress to do. So one step is, one track is legislation. The other is enforcement of what the of the court decrees, which establish the principle of equal protection. And I think that the phase that civil rights was in the late 1950s was the enforcement phase. There was a very important preliminary before the Congress turned over to legislation, and that was to make this notion of equal protection of the laws stick. And Eisenhower, as president, understood the maxim of his former chief, Douglas MacArthur, who had a saying, never give a command that will not be obeyed.
Hmm.
The idea here in the late 50s was to give full effect to the court's rulings on this matter, accompanied by legislation. In fact, far-reaching legislation was proposed in 57 and in 1960, but the purpose of legislation in 57 was to nod the Congress into not trying to pass laws that would obstruct the courts and so forth. The purpose of that was, I would say, moral. It was to push enforcement. When the torch passes from Eisenhower to Kennedy, civil rights, 1960, that year, which is a little bit behind the purview of this book, but 1960 resulted in a great quickening on this issue. You had sit-ins in the South. You had both parties taking a very strong position on civil rights at their respective conventions. You had the nomination of a Roman Catholic whose personal example in the fall campaign would speak volumes about the problem of prejudice in America and so on. And when Kennedy takes office in 61, we're in a new phase. We're in the new phase where legislation is now going to matter. I give Dwight Eisenhower, and I think recent historians have given him, real credit and understanding for making the for committing the executive branch and ultimately the legislative branch to the principle of equal protection of the laws. This was the Little Rock School affair was a major chapter in the history of civil rights. It put the U.S. Army and the coercive power of the federal government behind this principle. And by 60, 61, people were ready for new laws, and they came. And when they came, Dwight Eisenhower was for them.
Yeah. And what about his thoughts on Warren and on Brown versus mm-hmm. the Board of Education?
Well, what Warren had to do to reach the decision in Brown versus Board of Education is he and the court had to stretch the law. I read a book not long ago. In fact, I wrote an article on this, dealing with the internal debates of the Supreme Court on Brown versus Board of Education. And what Justice Jackson admitted privately is that, quote, there was not a justiciable basis for overruling separate but equal. In other words, all the precedent in Supreme Court law was in favor of separate but equal. That is the law of the land. What the court then in Brown versus Board of Education did is they went outside of the law to find sociological and moral reasons to overturn what was then existing law. That was necessary in the case of schools. They had to do that, and also in the case of desegregation. The problem with the Warren Court is that doing this in the case of Brown and school desegregation creates a kind of habit of mind that carries over into all kinds of decisions. They begin to expand criminal rights. They begin to expand, they secularize our schools. They outlaw school prayer. They go well beyond Brown and apply the principles of Brown. That is, the court can say what the law is to become sort of super legislators. And by late 1950s, I think Dwight Eisenhower had great misgivings about that aspect of the court. He was they were completely behind Brown in this sense. Warren was chosen as Chief Justice to finalize the Brown decision. Warren had struck down separate but equal in California as an attorney general. They knew exactly what Warren stood for. And during the debate of Brown versus Board of Education, they appoint Justice John Harlan to the bench, who was grandson of the only Supreme Court justice who dissented in Plessy v. Ferguson, saying in his dissent, quote, race has no place in American law. So the Eisenhower presidency appointed the Southern judges and the Supreme Court necessary to establish a judicial doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
Warren, who was a very fine man in many ways and a very historic figure, did, I think, willy-nilly extend this notion, this jurisprudence idea, that is, that the court must, in the final analysis, be arbiter of what is right and wrong in American life. I think he extended that idea willy-nilly into many areas, and that caused problems and caused a real issue with the court, which we're still fighting out in some way.
Let me do one more question for you. We have all four phone lines going for you, so I don't want to hog the conversation, but I found it absolutely fascinating that and you found this during the years of research and the interviews that you did. You say that you came to realize that World War II was the central event of Granddad's career. He entered politics primarily to consolidate on both the domestic and international fronts the victory gained in World War II. He asked the president to... he didn't want the title of Mr. President anymore. He wanted the general title after he retired. Isn't that astounding?
Well, Kathleen, you know, the thing is, I didn't draw a very tight line between those two points in the book. And, in fact, I left it sort of ambiguous, but I have answered some questions about it, and I think that your question brings us right to the point, which is that when Dwight Eisenhower retired from the presidency in the White House in 1961, and he looked back over his time in national and in international service, mindful of a legacy, as presidents are, he decided to take the title general. And I'm now convinced of this because it would symbolize in history that the deepest bond he had, the essence of the commitment that he undertook entering public service, was to win the peace on behalf of the GIs, the forces, the commands, the American people who fought and won World War II on two fronts. He was going to win the peace. And so the title general signifies that the critical moment in his career and in his life was, in fact, the invasion of Northwest Europe in 1944. As my father said to me on the phone not too long ago, I'd say about 4 weeks, we were talking about the book, in fact, And he said, you know, David, this is all fine and so forth. You know, I enjoy reading the histories of the Eisner years and so on, but, you know, at some level, never forget, all that mattered is that the weather, the landing craft, everything went off okay on the day, June 6, 1944. That's what really mattered in his life, and that's what the title mean. That's what the title general meant.
Yeah, and I want to talk, we'll get to it, but we have to go to phone calls, of your trip with him to Europe, where the crowds were just adoring him, and and you were a teenager, but you remember it. It was a big trip. Well, we're delighted to have David Eisenhower with us this hour of the program. His new book is Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. It covers the time from his going to Gettysburg, retiring from the presidency, to the time of his death, and his relationship with David, his thoughts about world leaders, his conversations with world leaders, is a little bit. And David's written another book about his time during World War II, but how the military life carried over in some ways in simple things like writing a letter to David offering to pay him to teach him Spanish. I don't know if that ever happened or not, but we'll get into some of that as well. We'll start with your phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Tomorrow during this time period, we're having a lot of political discussions this week, reminiscences. Walter Mondale will be joining us, a former vice president who just has written a memoir of his life in liberal politics, and it is titled The Good Fight. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The grandson of President Dwight Eisenhower, David Eisenhower, is our guest this hour. His book, just published by Simon & Schuster, Going Home to Glory. David is also the author of the bestseller Eisenhower at War, 1943 to 1945. He is now director of the Institute for Public Service at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. We start our calls with Phil from Mount Horeb. Hi, Phil. Hello, Phil. Are you there? Well, call us back. I don't know what happened to you. Scott is first from La Crosse. Hey. Hi, Scott.
First. Well, I beat out that Phil. That was my goal today. Hey, I got a question for you. I'm glad you were talking about civil rights. A few years back, I remember reading a book by the late Harry Reasoner who covered the civil rights struggle in the South. And his comparison to the way your grandfather handled Little Rock, and John F. Kennedy handled the desegregation of Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. And he points out in there that Kennedy tried to do it Kennedy, of course, was a Democrat, and the governor, the legislature, and all of us were Democrats. And he tried to do it by sending U.S. Marshals, and it really didn't work out very well.
Right.
Whereas your grandfather, being a top commander, understood that if you want to settle down a populace and shut down the rebel rousers, go big or don't go. And he sent down all those troops, and Little Rock went a lot smoother. And I guess my question for you, sir, is: did your grandfather ever discuss Kennedy's handling of all that?
He ruminated about it, and he felt that actually you put your finger on actually a very interesting comparison between the two situations that we've actually had a symposium on here at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was some years ago, and I was very interested in it. It's the this is something that runs through Going Home to Glory. In fact, Dwight Eisenhower sees various situations managed by Democratic successors, and they did have, and you put your finger on something, they did have a slightly different set of considerations than Eisenhower did. When Kennedy is dealing with Barnett of Mississippi, he's dealing with a nominal political ally, and so that caused Kennedy to adopt a policy in Oxford, Mississippi of gradualism, so to speak. Gradualism is applied in Vietnam. Gradualism is applied in Cuba. Many of the confrontations of the Eisenhower years, which are pretty sharply drawn, become sort of fuzzed up initially in the Democratic side with, I would say, consequences and a certain amount of confusion. And so people are actually killed in Oxford when the 101st finally intervenes there. I think it was the 101st. The town was in an uproar, and it was impossible to move Meredith, James Meredith, in and out of buildings without violent demonstrations and so on. This had been met in the Little Rock case with an overwhelming display of force at the outset, which pacified Little Rock and allowed the nine to enter. Though, having said that, Dwight Eisenhower was... Kennedy did move with decision, ultimately in Oxford, and then Kennedy takes the next step, and this was the key step, to accompany the next school desegregation problem, the one that he had in Alabama, with George Wallace and desegregation of University of Alabama Graduate School. He accompanies that with submission of an omnibus Civil Rights Act to get the country finally and conclusively behind this. So Kennedy deserves, I think, great credit for advancing this cause in American history. But you're absolutely right. Eisenhower, as a military man, understood the virtue of confronting the other side with hopeless odds. The art of war, or the art of the military science, is the art of prevailing. And the sooner the other side knows that they have been prevailed upon, the quicker conflict will sort of subside. And that's what happened in Little Rock. That's what did not happen in Oxford. Mm. But it did happen ultimately. John Kennedy gets great credit, I think, in the overall history of civil rights, no question.
Tell me about some of these conversations. And there were quite a few of them. I didn't realize that these had happened. When President Kennedy called President Eisenhower and met with him to talk about the Bay of Pigs fiasco, right, and also the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right. Well, you know, they were wary of one another, as might be expected,
mm-hmm,
when Kennedy takes office. But Dwight Eisenhower quickly developed a respect for President Kennedy's abilities as a president. Shortly after Kennedy takes office, there is the Bay of Pigs invasion. This is a carryover operation. It is apparently mismanaged by the Kennedy White House. Kennedy calls in Eisenhower to listen to the lessons that, of course, he knows Eisenhower is going to impart. Eisenhower could not approve of the handling of Bay of Pigs. But what begins to happen thereafter, and it culminates in Cuba, and then in meetings after Cuba, I think that they developed John Kennedy began to value Dwight Eisenhower's advice. His advice during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Kennedy was receiving advice from many, many sources, but Eisenhower's advice in particular, I think, was of definite interest, was great advice. You know, this is what we pay presidents to get things right, and Eisenhower had been a president, and Kennedy was a president. The key question that Kennedy had for Eisenhower in the Cuban Missile Crisis was, the United States wants to take decisive action in Cuba to compel the Soviets to remove missiles. Will the Soviets connect Cuba with Berlin? Will decisive American action in Cuba be met by a major Soviet provocation in Berlin? Eisenhower paused over that. And in fact, I've listened to the tape many times provided by the Kennedy Library, tape of that conversation. Eisenhower pauses, and he says they will not connect. This is an opportunistic venture on the Soviet part. In other words, you can proceed in safety with a blockade. This is what you pay presidents get right.
Right.
And,
yes.
This Kennedy got it right also. And this is why we... they consult later. I didn't even cover all the meetings that they had. They consulted I don't know if they talked by phone, but they consulted through Vice President Johnson on civil rights. They consulted on the Bermuda summit involving Harold Macmillan and NATO matters. Kathleen, you mentioned the trip that I went on with my grandfather at age 14.
Yes, please tell us about that. It's such a wonderful story.
When Dwight Eisenhower returned from this 38-day trip through Europe, which I was on, the president asked him to come to Washington for a conversation. The Kennedy Library has a tape recording of that conversation, and they sent it to me. And so I had the delightful experience as a writer listening to Dwight Eisenhower and John Kennedy discuss the very trip that I was on.
What a thrill.
Meetings that I had little journal entries on. This was a great experience in my life, by the way. I was 14, and my grandparents decided that my sister Ann and I should come. They decided to travel with a couple, Jane and Freeman Gosden of Los Angeles. They had young children about our age, and so we went on this amazing tour of Western Europe 17 years after VE Day. That's a decade plus. And it was on that trip that I saw in the flesh, I guess. What I saw made tangible is something that I guess I'd known about, but that was the extraordinary connection between Dwight Eisenhower and post-war Europe, and the outcome of that war. That was I just remember the throngs in West Germany, the throngs beneath our hotel balcony in Cologne, the throngs that turned out in Paris, the throngs in Copenhagen, London, and I'd heard about these things, but I just hadn't seen it. And what a difference that made.
I would imagine all of this for your grandfather. You see him in a whole different way, don't you?
Yeah, you do. I think that, lots of us in America, there are a lot of special Americans. And I don't think that my experience is completely unprecedented at all. I think we all know extraordinary people. And there are moments when you're around these extraordinary people where you are set apart, you are told, in effect, to sort of stand in the audience, and you see them in a more objective way. You see them the way the public sees these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it is in those moments that you gain an appreciation for what fine people and what leaders in our country do contribute. And that is something that I saw in a couple of cases with my grandfather. I saw him in crowds for the first time after he left office, beginning with the night he returned to Gettysburg.
My. And you see, and we're losing so many of the people from World War II, but his contributions to World War II, his incredible leadership, and then you couple that with, Pearl Harbor Day and seeing these people, and there are so few of them left now whose world was so different than our world's. And
well, I'm glad they've left the record that they have.
Yes.
The World War II story is a stunning story. It's the story, I'm convinced, of the 20th century. It is such a huge event, and we had the good sense to make movies about it, to write thousands and thousands of books about it, to make sure that everybody was debriefed. The Greatest Generation was interviewed by countless people, led by Stephen Ambrose. We have this fabulous record in every way, shape, or form, which is now permanent. I think future generations will look back on the middle of the 20th century, and they'll be just stunned by the sweep of World War II, what was decided there, the kind of evil that became manifest in World War II, the duties that that imposed on America, our ability to respond to it, the efforts by our allies, our comrades in arms, the precedent they set in international cooperation, the birth of a new world. It's just an unbelievable event.
Yeah, it sure is. Phil is our next caller from Mount Horeb. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I am interested in asking a question about President Eisenhower's farewell address and to get your perspective on that a little bit from a viewer's or a listener's point. I'm going to read a couple of brief sentences, if I may, to set the stage. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. I wonder if you spoke with your grandfather, sir, about his comments or his thoughts in this regard, and if you could amplify them and share his concern about
military-industrial complex.
Military-industrial complex. You know, listening to you read that, thank you for doing that. I actually heard a word that I had not paid attention to when I've looked at this very, very famous speech. I think it's considered one of the top 10 speeches of the 20th century, as is the Kennedy inaugural that follows 72 hours later. It's a fascinating, an amazing confluence of great speeches in early 61, which is exactly where Going Home to Glory opens. Going Home to Glory opens 72 hours after my grandfather gave this speech. All right, first answer is no, he never discussed this with me. I know that he discussed it with friends, and I have their diaries, and they picked up the diary accounts pick up discussions that people had. But listening to you read that, the word that jumped out at me was the military-industrial complex, not a military-industrial complex, the military-industrial complex. It existed. And, in fact, what that reminds me of is that there are documents from late Truman era, early Eisenhower era, entitled Reports on the Military-Industrial Complex. We had such a thing. And there were policies toward it. There were policies emanating from it. And what I think Dwight Eisenhower was doing here, you have these two great speeches, Kennedy inaugural, Eisenhower farewell, back-to-back. And I know something about the origins of both speeches. And there's a interesting thing about it. At one point, in the drafting of the Kennedy inaugural and the drafting of the Eisenhower farewell, which coincided, this was going on in December of 1960, early January 61, these two speeches might have been perceived as a kind of an argument, Kennedy taking on Eisenhower, Eisenhower taking on Kennedy. The 60 election had been very close in the early
drafts. Very close.
Yeah, very close. And the early drafts of the Eisenhower farewell reflected the enormous disappointment the Republicans felt in the outcome. So the early drafts of the Eisenhower speech are sort of directed toward his successor, saying, don't do this, don't do that. Somebody gets to the president and says, that's not appropriate. You should really be helping the new administration. Simultaneously, Kennedy's advisors are telling him that he's got to pledge continuity, that he has got to give Eisenhower his due, he's got to bring Republicans into his cabinet, and so forth. And then somebody gets to Kennedy and says, your task is to lead. Eisenhower's task is to surrender power. Kennedy's is to take it. And so the character in the later drafts of both speeches changed completely. Kennedy's becomes a classic and eternal assumption of power. This is how a young leader takes office, this way. And Eisenhower's becomes the greatest farewell warning ever addressed. And what it is it's a retrospective on the 20th century that addresses the riddle of the 20th century. The great riddle is, how can Western society advance so far technologically, advance so rapidly, and grow so much on one hand, and on the other hand, experience the disasters, the tragedies on the scale that we did in the 20th century, the Great Depression, two world wars. There's a sense here that democracy had lost its grip, that the adages that caused America to happen, our constitutional constraints, our individual freedoms, that all of these had been sort of overwhelmed by the 20th century. And Eisenhower's analysis, looking back over this, and this is what makes it timeless, is that what went wrong in Europe, what went wrong in the industrialized world in that era, is that people stopped being citizens. They withdrew into their shells, into their private worlds, and they allowed a military-industrial complex. They allowed scientific, technological elites. At one point in the drafting, there were all kinds of complexes listed here. They allowed T teams of people who would govern on your behalf to preempt decisions that citizens must make. And so his call going out the door is, you are going to be bewildered in the coming decades by technical advice, by people who purport to know more than you do, by a military-industrial complex today, an educational, scientific, technological complex tomorrow. Remember this. If it does not make sense to you, speak out, take action. Be self-reliant, be a citizen. And that is exactly what that means. The military-industrial complex is actually smaller, measured in terms of GDP today, than it was in 1961. But I think the basic point is there. We do not want people preempting decisions that we must make, and we have to recognize when that's being done. And so that's what the speech is about. It's timeless as a result.
It is timeless.
Still around 50 years ago, as it ought to be, and as is the Kennedy inaugural, and we'll be looking at the 50th anniversary of both speeches next month.
Oh, okay. Let's do a talk show. We should listen to both of those. Christy and I have been listening to it. We should listen to those. That'd be good. You make further mention, which I found really fascinating, David, that Eisenhower later developed a kind of split personality about the most controversial speech of his life. Among business friends and military colleagues, you write, he was defensive and even self-critical about his speech with others.
I think so, because I think that what he, well, his colleagues didn't like it much. You know, I can remember. I can remember encountering one of them, nameless, saying, "You know, this Malcolm Moose at University, or who became president, University of Minnesota, put these words in the general's mouth." I heard that over and over again in the late '60s. That the suggestion that somebody put words in Dwight Eisenhower's mouth, and I think that the point that he was making to his friends was by not pressing the point in private, is that it was not personal. It was a reflection on a condition, not specific actions of specific individuals. It's just we lived and live today, 2010, in a complex world. It's oftentimes hard to locate where decisions are being made. They're usually being made, decisions that affect our lives are being made long way from where we are. We live in a complex world, and citizenship requires effort. Being a free person in America 2010 requires a lot of effort. It requires, if not education, at least awareness of the world around you. It requires you to join associations, to make friends, and to take charge of the factors that really affect your life. And that's the way it is. Eisenhower did not mean it personally. He's not criticizing Lucius Clay or Ellis Slater or any of his friends. But so he did not make a point of it in private. But if you look at his writings and you look at his speeches throughout this period of his years in going home to glory, there's no doubt that this is the deepest lesson that he drew from his time in public service, and he meant it as a legacy, as a warning, as a kind of lodestar for future generations to come. No question.
And it has stayed with us all those years.
Sure has.
Yeah, it sure has.
You know, Kathleen, I was listening. You're having Vice President Mondale.
Yes, tomorrow.
Yes, that's very thrilling. I'm glad he's out with a book. That brings something to mind, too, and that is his chief, President Carter. One of the best books in recent politics that I've read is Douglas Brinkley's The Unfinished Presidency, which is about Jimmy Carter. Another one of my favorite books is Candace Millard's River of Doubt about Teddy Roosevelt.
That's a great book.
Great book. One of the neglected subjects, I think, in American history is what happens to presidents when they leave office.
Right.
Our 22nd Amendment requires presidents to leave office. And that brings to sort of an unnatural end times in public service that might be, forever in a lot of cases. And what happens to people under those circumstances, I think, is significant. Those are two instances of wonderful character studies of individuals who are easier to know when they're out of office. Vice President Mondale, I'm sure, would have plenty to plenty of light to shed on that.
Yes, I think you would like his book. It's a lovely book. I haven't finished it yet because I've been reading your book.
And, yes, I've met the vice president a number of times, and I respect him very much. And he's not from too far away from you.
That's right.
Right across the state line, I guess.
Right. We'll welcome more phone calls. David Eisenhower is our guest this hour. And as David told you, Walter Mondale is our guest tomorrow during this time period. He's written his memoir, and it's a lovely read, as is David's. David Eisenhower is author of Going Home to Glory, A Memoir of Life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969, the years after he left the presidency until his death. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Eisenhower, our guest. Just a few little fun moments. Your grandfather wrote you a note, I believe it was when you were at Exeter, telling you that he would pay you if you would teach him Spanish. Did you ever do that?
You never did.
You didn't.
never did. But, you know, he's just looking for, I guess, ways to introduce me to the working world and so on. I was, hired to as a hand on the farm, and he was always coming up with little projects like that. And I think it was just as, I actually did teach Spanish in high school.
Did you?
I tutored a couple of people at it, yes. And so I might have tutored him, but he just wanted to give me the work, I think.
Little tidbits about him. He liked to read Westerns.
Yes, he sure did. He liked Western. He escaped with Westerns. It must have been a setting that appealed to him. He was raised in Abilene, Kansas. Abilene, Kansas was a real famous cow town in the late 19th century. Wild Bill Hickok had been the town marshal for several years. This is maybe 15 years before Dwight knew anything about it, but the legends, the tradition in that town was very colorful and established by the time he's raised. And so the idea of these Western novels, Boot Hill is about 10 miles from Abilene. This was these are all novels set in a place that he grew up, and so he must have been very intrigued by the setting, the man versus nature themes, the expanse and the endlessness of the West, and how that fires our imagination.
Right. Let's go to Randy from Antigo. Hi, Randy.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, I have read quite a few publications. This is going back to late 1942. A lot of publications stating that the United States and British intelligence knew about 80% of concentration camps in Germany and Austria. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the United States put it off till the end of the war. All the generals knew where a lot of these logistics were. And after the war, they got criticized quite a bit for it. They probably could have saved quite a few lives.
Well, I don't know how they could have saved lives. That's the catch, because this came up in the question of bombing Auschwitz and so on. Your point about about the system of terror in Nazi Germany and the concentration camp system, I would second that, and I would even add this. Not only did we know, at least our intelligence agencies, it was policy of the Nazi government to make sure that everybody at some level knew. What kept the German army in the field until 1945 is the fear of retribution, and what fueled that fear was knowledge on the part of the Germans themselves, communicated in a very sinister and indirect way that great crimes had been done in their name, and there would be a terrible retribution if they stopped fighting. I think another way of putting it is that the camps in Europe were an open secret. Now, it's how lives could have been saved, I don't know. You know, the suggestion for Auschwitz was to divert American bombers to destroy that complex. Well, you know, the camp victims themselves were in those complexes. And if they had been bombed, I don't know if lives could have been saved. This is a terribly freighted, unbelievable topic, and I don't have answers for it. I will say this, that knowing of this system and then encountering it were two things. as much as Eisenhower, Churchill, Roosevelt certainly, and our intelligence services were aware of the extent of Nazi terror, and I believe they were, to actually encounter it on the ground, to walk through Buchenwald, to open Auschwitz, to see this thing in the flesh, was a profound experience for Americans, Westerners, Russians, Germans, everybody. This created, brought about one of the great moments of self-awareness in world history. Mm-hmm. And it has, I think, there is a kind of delayed reaction. You know, for many years, the history of World War II sort of centered on the rivalries between the generals and strategies, though this is some sort of civil war.
We have 5 seconds.
Yes, but since then, this great story that the caller has referred to has come to the forefront. It is the story of World War II.
It sure is.
One that we still mull over.
David, thank you so much. You're really engaging and real smart, and I just really enjoyed the hour. Thank you.
Kathleen, I loved it, and thank you, and thank you for having me on the show, and good luck, and stay warm out there in Milwaukee.
Okay, we'll try. And David Eisenhower, Coming Home to Glory is the name of the book, and it's well worth a read.